vesicles that are highly enriched in receptors. And initially, you disturb that ordered arrangement you see there, and the receptors are randomly arranged in the membrane, but as you leave them around in a low salt buffer, the receptors start to recrystallize, and you can see ribbons of dimers reappearing here. And as you leave the vesicles in the membrane longer, the dimers get longer, the ribbons of dimers get longer, and they pack together side by side and start deforming the vesicles, and in the end, these tubes grow out of them, and we call them tubular crystals. And of course, we look at them by cryo method so that the structure is well preserved. So, and we also look at them over holes in the carbon film, so that they're hollow tubes and actually susceptible to deformation, not quite as rugged as the structures say Tim was talking about this morning. And it's very important that you look at them over a hole so that they're not touching anything other than water, because otherwise they'll flatten a bit, and that makes them sort of unacceptable for analysis. If you look at higher magnification, you see the individual receptors in the middle looking down, donuts there. And, of course, you see them edge on at the side of the tube. And the way it's arranged is such that the part on the outside is the part that would be sticking into the synapse. So it's an outside-out vesicle, you might call it. And it's about 800 angstroms across. Of course, the basic problem in microscopy is radiation damage, and you take these pictures at low doses, and that means that when you look at an individual receptor, it is very noisy because you haven't hit it with all that many electrons. And to get the high-resolution structure of an individual receptor molecule, you have to average over many of those identical units. Well, this is made possible because of the helical symmetry of the tube. They're arranged like this, with the ribbons of dimers forming a helical path up the tube, and give diffraction patterns, optical diffraction patterns, like this. Well, of course, you've already learnt a lot about how one analyzes these patterns from David DeRosier and Ron and Andy and Andrew in the classes. So there's no need for me to say much about it, but one particular feature of these patterns is that they don't go out to very high resolution. They only go out to about 30 angstroms, and you don't see anything more than that. And there are two reasons for that. One is, of course, that the ordered regions of the tubes are fairly short, so there's not that much information in just a couple of thousand receptors, so the diffraction pattern hasn't got a very good signal to noise ratio from that point of view. But also, it turns out that the tubes are not straight at all, and they're actually bent both in the plane of the ice and out of the plane of the ice, and have variable twists, and because of those distortions, the diffraction pattern fades out or gets more and more blurred as you get to a higher resolution, and that's what stops you seeing anything beyond about 30 angstroms, that plus four statistics. But in the first stages of the averaging to look at the structure, we didn't worry about the distortions. We worried mainly about the statistics. To improve the statistics, what we had to do was add or average the information from a number of tubes, so to build up the number of receptors contributing so that the genuine detail corresponding to each of those individual images, like you saw in the previous slide, is reinforced, and the statistical variations which arise from the sort of hitting in different places by electrons get smeared out. And when you to do that, you can actually extend the resolution out to about 9 angstroms. And the tubes about 9 angstroms look like this. This is the surface presentation. And this is what they would look like in cross-section. And so in cross-section, you can see here we've cut through an individual receptor molecule, and you can see the walls of the iron pathway down the center are protruding about 60 angstroms into the synaptic cleft. You can see the phospholipid head groups of the bilayer making a double ring structure, and you can see details of the channel on the inside of the membrane. And that's basically what you can see at 9 angstroms. Actually, this is at about 15 angstroms, but you don't see that much more. But to understand the mechanism, of course, you want to understand the change that happens when you add acetylcholine to the receptors and actually open the channel. In this picture, of course, we haven't added acetylcholine, so the channel is closed and it's blocked in the middle of the membrane there. Well, to look at the channel open, we had to spray acetylcholine onto the tubes. And maybe this method has been talked about in the course. So when you're blotting, you blot your grid and then you punch it into ethane. Just before it hits the ethane surface, the idea is you spray droplets containing acetylcholine and hit the tubes, and then you trap the reaction by the freezing. And you have to do this by having this distance D2 very small. You can make the time between the spray hitting the tubes and the trapping of the reaction as small as 5 milliseconds. And you have to do this because the receptors go into a desensitized state after about 20 milliseconds where they become closed again in a different conformation than the closed channel. We don't want to see that. We want to understand how the channel opens. And with a short exposure like this, one expects something like 90% of the channels to be open, as long as they've been hit by the acetylcholine. And by having ferritin in the solution, we can check whether we've hit or not by making sure that ferritin is surrounding the tube in the image. If there's no ferritin there, you can't be confident that it's been hit by acetylcholine. So you wouldn't process that image as though it's an open channel. Anyhow, in the early stages of this research, we looked at the channel at 9 angstroms before we'd added acetylcholine and after we'd added acetylcholine. And we saw some differences that allowed us to suggest the mechanism of how the channel opens. And I can just sort of sketch it here. What we observed was that in the two alpha subunits, there were small rotations, clockwise rotations, when you're looking down from the synaptic cleft. And what we could see in the membrane, we could resolve helices lining the pore there and blocking the pore in the middle of the membrane. The density sort of went across there. And what we suggested was that this rotation somehow was transmitted to these helices and caused them to sort of move out sideways and break whatever the gate or whatever was blocking the channel in the middle there and open it up there. We could see an opening in the middle of the membrane after we'd sprayed the acetylcholine on, as well as the rotation. And also we could see that the structure on the outside didn't change between the two. So just to summarize, those are the three things we could see. Clockwise rotations in both alpha subunits. The pore opens in the middle of the membrane, and the outer part of the membrane didn't seem to change its structure. So, of course, that's sort of a sketch of how it opens, and this was in 1995, and what we wanted to do, of course, was to be able to describe that more properly, which really means going to a higher resolution. And to go to a higher resolution, of course, we had to worry about those distortions that I was telling you about, and we also had to use the best microscope we could. And let me just say a little bit about those two aspects. The way we corrected for distortions, again, it's probably even talked about in the course, but it's rather like correcting for distortions in a two-dimensional crystal, except actually with a helix, you're better off because you can do the corrections in three dimensions. A helix is very sensitive to the fact if you're slightly out of the plane perpendicular to the beam. You can actually measure that quite accurately with a helix. And the idea is that you divide the helix up into very short segments, and the segments are short enough that in a segment like this, each receptor would be in the correct lattice position to within, say, 2 angstroms if you've got a very short segment. If you have a longer segment, of course, they would depart by more than 2 angstroms from the correct lattice position. So if you have it short enough, they would be approximately on the correct lattice positions. If then you can align it to a reference where they're all on the correct lattice positions, which involves determining these 7 parameters here, and then at another segment that's perfectly aligned to, say, 2 angstroms accuracy, and keep on adding them up, you should end up with a structure in principle that's accurate to 2 angstroms. At least this is talking about long range type of distortions like bending and twisting, slow twisting and moving out of the plane of the ice. Basically, we corrected distortions this way by adding up lots and lots of segments. The actual segment length is a critical thing in this method, because if you have a long segment, the receptors are not in their correct lattice positions, so they're further out, so you're getting a blurred structure when you average. If the segment's too short, there's not enough signal there to get all these parameters that you need to align it to the reference structure. In actual practice, we found the ideal segment length was something a little bit shorter than the diameter of the tube. And then, of course, so that's basically the way you correct for distortions, and it does work very well. And then the other thing is, of course, we need to use a very, very good microscope. And the problem here is that the tubes, very good tubes of receptors, don't come very easily. And you have to work all day, actually. You have to spend, say, 10 or 12 hours on a microscope to get one good picture. And what you want to be sure of when you take the picture is that there's nothing wrong with it electron optically. There's absolutely no movement, and you know, the information, if it was there, would be there up to 4 angstroms or less. And for that reason, we felt we had to work together with Yoshi in Japan, who has this very special microscope that I'll say a little bit more about in the next slide. So that every picture we took, the idea was, it didn't work out like this in the beginning, but the idea was every picture we took was sort of perfect electron optically. And we also thought that because it used the liquid helium stage, you know, if there's a gain of a factor of 2 at liquid helium temperatures over nitrogen temperatures, that means that there's sort of, to get the same signal noise ratio, we need half as many images. So it was worth going to Japan for. So let me just say a little bit about this microscope and the very special stage. Here's the Joule 300 kV field emission microscope, and the stage is in this part where the arrow is here around the objective lens. And it's sort of built into the microscope column. There's a sort of pre-cooling that you have with the liquid nitrogen tank, and then proper cooling with liquid helium. And it's sort of sucked down a capillary here into a little pot here, so which completely surrounds the specimen. And it's a top entry stage. It's a symmetrical design. which makes it extremely stable. So actually, in the early days, we couldn't actually, many times, we just couldn't take any good images at all, because one of the problems with liquid helium temperatures is that the conductivity gets very poor, and we had problems with beam-induced movement, but we found ways of overcoming that, and I think it's fair to say that after 2 or 3 years of getting that to work, when we took pictures, we actually don't think about movement. We just think of finding good tubes. So the stability was really the key thing in this microscope. And in these early days, the three people here, some of you will have seen them before. This is Yoshi and Atso and Ramin, who really developed that method for correcting for distortions. And this is in an early, this is where, this must be about 1996. Because this is when we more or less started, and I think perhaps we'd been working for a year or so, and I remember the first year we didn't get any good pictures at all. We took lots and lots, but they all showed movement. And each image we put in a book, and at this stage there's I think there's 13 green books there, which means we'd sort of processed 13 images successfully. Continuing with that, and adding lots of images and correcting for distortions, we got to a stage where we could see the receptor at 4.6 angstroms resolution. I don't think we did a Fourier shell correlation to show that actually, but we did sort of. But you could actually see bits of beta sheet, the 4.7 angstrom spacing, you could see bits of beta sheet in this ligand binding part of the receptor, so we knew that we had about that resolution. And at this stage, actually, it's quite good at looking at the architecture of the receptor, but it doesn't tell you in detail about the internal folding, which is important to know, of course. And what's interesting about the architecture is that this ion pathway, you know, it's wide as you go down the ligand binding domain, it gets narrow and forms the gate in the middle of the membrane, and then widens again on the outside with these windows, you can see quite nicely now, that allow the ions, so the ions come in and out sideways, sort of, at the bottom there. It's usually it's sodium ions going down this way, but actually as they go down, the voltage drops close to zero, and then potassium ions start coming up this way. I'm going to concentrate on talking to you, first of all, about this part, and then the part in the membrane. And this part, now that these parts, we were a bit stuck there, you know, one could just go on. At this stage, we'd collected about 150 images, which is meant averaging about 500,000 receptors. And we could just go on and adding more and improving the signal-to-noise ratio and therefore for the resolution. But actually at that stage, we were lucky in that Tishia Sixma's group solved the structure of an acetylcholine binding protein, which is a pentamer, which is homologous to this part of the receptor. And it's soluble, it doesn't contain the membrane spanning part. But, you know, because we had 4.6 angstrom resolution, we could fit this X-ray structure at 2.5 angstrom resolution into the density map quite reliably. You can see there that the overall shape matches the shape of the ligand binding domain of the subunit quite well. Actually, in fitting it, it wasn't totally straightforward, and to describe that, I need to just explain a little bit more about the structure. So in the acetylcholine binding protein, the acetylcholine comes into a site here, which is between two sets of beta sheets, making a beta sandwich. There's an outer sheet in red, and there's an inner sheet, which is sort of facing the pore mainly, particularly at the bottom. So it's on the inside. And then these two sheets are linked together through a disulfide bridge. And then there's some loops that come down at the bottom. This loop, beta-1, beta-2, I'll be talking a little bit more about in a few minutes. And it comes down and interacts with the membrane spanning structure that I'll also be talking about. But of course, in the binding protein, it's not there. When it came to fitting the binding protein to the density of composing the receptor, we found that both the inner and outer sheet structure, as they are in the binding protein, fitted very well to the delta, the beta, and the gamma subunits. But we couldn't just fit them to the alphas. The only way we could make them fit nicely was to fit the two sheets independently, the reds to the outside and the blues to the inside. And this is because in the two alpha subunits, the sheets are distorted compared to their positions in the gamma, the delta, and the beta. And remember, the alpha subunits are the subunits to which the ligand acetylcholine binds. And there is a ligand actually in the sole structure as well. So in the two alpha subunits, the inner sheets are both rotated anti-clockwise by about 15 degrees compared to their positions in the other subunits or in the pentamer of the binding protein. And the outer sheets are actually changed a little bit too. And remember I told you that when we sprayed acetylcholine onto the tubes, we observed rotations in the two alpha subunits. And when we saw, and they were clockwise rotations, so when we saw these distortions, we thought maybe what happens is that when the acetylcholine binds, the subunits become undistorted. In other words, the 15 degrees distortion in these inner sheets actually sort of goes back so that all the subunits become equivalent. And indeed, that is essentially what happens. What we could show at low resolution was that if you look at a section in the structure, and what we were looking at in the previous slide was a section at this level where that disulfide bridges, if we look at a section, or actually this is a sort of slab here, before we add acetylcholine, and then after we add acetylcholine, you can see they're quite different in this region where these asterisks are, and this is a difference map between the two. So this has a sort of rather angular sort of hole here, whereas this has a sort of more elliptical one. Well, now in this structure we were able to fit because it was without acetylcholine, we were able to fit the densities, and these two alphas have the anti-clockwise rotated inner sheets. Well, what we found was that you can do sort of experiments, sort of mutation experiments in the computer. You can replace the subunit with one of the non-alpha subunits, like a delta, beta, or a gamma, and you know exactly the orientation to put it in to make it sort of pentagonally symmetrical, like it is in these delta, beta, and gamma subunits. And when you do that, make a hybrid sort of receptor, making it gamma, gamma, gamma. Actually, you remove that distortion caused by the rotations of the inner sheets, and it makes it very much like that. And the different peaks actually sort of more or less disappear. It does become a rather symmetrical structure, and it's not completely a circle in the middle. It's more elliptical because in the receptor, actually, the spacing between the subunits is a bit different because they have different side chains sticking out at the interfaces. So what we were able to show was that looking at that structure, and this is looking at the beta sheet part that we were able to fit to the densities, before acetylcholine is bound, these inner sheets in blue here of the alpha subunits were rotated anti-clockwise by 15 degrees, and when acetylcholine bound, they rotated clockwise by about 15 degrees. So they went from there to there. And the The rotation was about that disulfide bridge. So the structure went from an asymmetric type of structure to a more symmetrical structure, with all the subunits essentially becoming the same. So just to summarize that part of the talk, what we understand about the structure is it's rather like an allosteric protein with the two alpha subunits in a tense, distorted state before acetylcholine binds. When acetylcholine binds, it overcomes those distortions and makes the subunits just like they want to be, like the other ones. And so it goes from a sort of asymmetric structure to a more symmetric structure. So what we want, so this change, now that we can see in the ligand binding domain, the next question is, how is that communicated to the membrane spanning part? And actually it's got a lot to do with the loops that were coming down from the top of the structure down towards the membrane, at least these loops beta 1, beta 2, and if you notice they rotate a lot when you add acetylcholine. So our next step was to look at the membrane spanning pore, and 4.6 angstroms, you know, wasn't enough resolution for us to decide exactly what the structure was like in the membrane. The structure in the ligand binding domain in green there was easy because we knew it must be very similar to the acetylcholine binding protein. But in the membrane, it's actually alpha helices, but we weren't sure of the alpha helical structure apart from the one that was lining the pore. And we had to, therefore, improve the resolution, and that actually involved just collecting more and more images. And in the end, with about 350 images, we were sort of rather satisfied that we could understand the details there quite clearly. And actually, it's quite interesting how the cross-section in the membrane looks at when you've averaged 10,000 images. You can hardly make out the receptor at this resolution. It's very noisy. After you've added 100,000, you can begin to see the shape of the receptor, but really you need about 1,000,000, and then you can identify cross-sections of each of the helices going through the membrane. And if you do Fourier shell correlations, they go up to a level of the correlation is about 0.5 at 4 angstroms. I haven't got time to talk about it afterwards, but to do this, what we did was we worked with four different helical families, so like different sort of space groups, and we added the transforms that we did in reciprocal space for each family, and then we took receptors out of each, the average receptors out of each family, and added them together in real space to get this sort of combined three-dimensional map that was good enough to see where the side chains were. And this here shows an example of densities in the membrane where we're standing inside the pore and looking at a couple of the alpha helices. And these big side chains, the resolution is only 4 angstroms, so it's certainly not good to see see all the side chains reliably, but the big side chains all seem to give bumps, and so we know where the big side chains are, and there's also so much known about the structure. Every amino acid in the membrane part has been sort of labeled with lipid-soluble dyes or water-soluble dyes, so you know what's facing the lipid and what's facing the water. So when you get your structure, you can confirm that it all makes sense, and it does make sense. So I'm quite confident that we've got the folding right and the positions of the side chains right, although we don't exactly know the orientations of all the side chains. And And so the structure, you know, looking at it, it's like this. It's an alpha helical structure in the membrane, and sitting on top of it is this asymmetrical ligand binding domain. I emphasize this is asymmetrical, at least before you add acetylcholine, because the part in the membrane is actually very symmetrical. If you look at the helices down the axis of the pore, they fit very accurately into a pentagonally positioned. They're accurately pentagonal as you go around the ring. And they're made up, you see, each of the subunits is made up of four alpha helices. And it's particularly the inner three ones, the M2, the M1, and M3, that fit in strictly pentagonal positions as you go around the ring. The outer one is rather distorted and in fact not making contact with the other helices apart from the bottom part. Now, I wanted to describe these details in a little bit more, because I'm going to come to the gate of the channel, which is really the really interesting part. We need to know the structure of the gate, and we want to know how it is broken when the channel opens, when the acetylcholine binds. So these inner helices, M2, are sort of tapered as they come down, and you can see that as you go down them now, they're sort of going inwards, and then just down near the middle of the membrane there, they sort of bend backwards. So just about there, they sort of straighten up and almost go in the other direction. And if you look at them from the side, you see that they're sort of splayed apart as you go up towards the synaptic side of the membrane. And the M4s on the outside are all a little bit different. And what is interesting is that the M1 and M3 make a very regular ring, a sort of left-handed coil as you go around the axis. And the way the topology is a classical fold, rather like, say, in TMV. The M1 is connected to the ligand binding domain, goes down through the membrane. There's a short loop there, M1, M2, and then it connects up to this membrane lining the pore, and this helix lining the pore, M2. There's another loop there that sort of interacts, as we'll see in a minute, with the ligand binding domain. There's another helix that goes through the membrane, and there's a big loop here that we haven't fitted to the densities yet, which makes that cytoplasmic structure, those windows that we saw before. Now I want to come to the gate of the channel, which is made by these M2 helices. These are the amino acid residues that are facing the axis of the pore. On either side of the head groups of the membrane, there are rings of negatively charged residues. Not all the residues are negatively charged as you go around the ring. Like this one, the alphas are serines here, but some of the others are negatively charged. And these rings, we think, are helpful in attracting cations through the narrow part of the channel and repelling anions. And they probably help in making it highly conductive for cations, but sort of zero conductance for anions. And in fact, people have mutated them and shown that this is the case. And in the middle of the membrane, we have these big hydrophobic residues that make it most constricted. But actually, they're still quite a long way away from the axis of the pore, as you can see in the space-filling model here. So the red here is the negatively charged residues on either side that are helping to make it cation selective. And then the gate part, the narrowest part in the middle of the membrane, is sort of a zone of hydrophobic residues. Now, the question is, why do ions just sort of not go through that hole there? Because that hole is actually a lot bigger than than an individual ion. To answer that, I wanted to show you the way the channel is as you look down the pore. There are these negatively charged glutamic acid residues near the entrance, the synaptic side of the structure. And as you go down the pore into the middle of the membrane, you get this hydrophobic ring that's still quite wide, and then it gets polar again. Well, if you look at this hydrophobic ring and compare it here with the size of an ion with a shell of water molecules around it, you can see that a hydrated ion is actually is big compared to that hydrophobic ring. And if the ions have a shell of water molecules which around them, which they always do, the ion is in effect too big to get through that polar, that hydrophobic hole there. Now they can easily go through other parts because the polar groups can of course replace the water molecules, substitute for the water molecules. But if there are no if there are no polar groups in the middle of the membrane, there's nothing there to replace the water molecule, so the ion effectively stays about 8 angstroms in diameter, and therefore it's too big to go through. So I guess most people think of a gate as being something that actually occludes the ion, comes in and blocks it, but in this particular case it's really a sort of energetic barrier for the ions. It doesn't allow the ions to shed its shell of water molecules, and that makes the ion size effectively too big to go through. And actually, molecular dynamics experiments have been done by Mark Sanson's group, where they've mimicked essentially the acetylcholine pore and seeing what happens to water molecules when you have a hydrophobic ring like this in the middle. And what they've been able to show is that water doesn't even go through a hydrophobic hole like that very easily. They measured how easily the water flows by this parameter openness here. It has to be something like about 9 angstroms across before water will go through, let alone an ion. And in the molecular dynamics results, it's actually quite interesting because in this, it's like a little Teflon tube, and even water isn't stable in there. And what seems to happen in the molecular dynamics results is that it's either sort of like a vacuum, or it's sort of stochastic. There's water comes in and out. Almost like steam. Bits of water there sometimes, and not other times. So if water can't go through, obviously ions can't go through either. So that's how we think the gate is, an energy barrier to the ions. The final thing is, how does the gate open when acetylcholine binds? Now, we saw the ligand binding domain, this beta sheet structure, and here it's superimposed now on the membrane spanning part. And if you look at the two alpha subunits, you see that this loop, beta 1, beta 2, fits right over the top of the alpha helices belonging to the alpha subunits that are lining the pore. The other helices are sort of not in the direct pathway of the ions. It's just the inner ring of M2 helices that are lining the pore that are in the path of the ions. And what you might expect is that when this does this 15 degrees clockwise rotation, when the acetylcholine binds, it moves the helices with it. Now that means this loop has to be interacting with the top of the helix there. And actually, you can see this quite nicely in the density maps. There's a valine residue at the end of that loop, and it seems to fit into a hydrophobic pocket made by the end of the helices and the two alpha subunits. I guess, you know, this is slightly a cheating picture because we can see these helices in the membrane very well. We can see this beta sheet very well. These loop, this loop, beta 1, beta 2, actually we can see very clearly, but there are some non-homologous parts of the binding protein that are not quite the same as in the binding protein. So this isn't a total sort of atomic structure of the extracellular domain. Some of these loops, we don't really know their positions yet all that well. But we do know that this moving part here is connected to the top of the helices lining the pore in the case of the alpha subunits. And it doesn't seem to be, it seems to be quite a long way away from them and the other subunits because they're in a different sort of position because they haven't got this 15 degrees distortion. So the way the channel must open then is by these rotations being transmitted through the spadine residue to this helix and somehow breaking the bonds that are formed in this holding the gate together in this region of the channel. Well, it turns out that the residues forming the gate there are both hydrophobic, pointing into the pore, the valine and the leucine there, and also the hydrophobic contacts between the helices. In the top part of the helices, they're actually so far apart, the residues aren't really touching each other as you go around the ring. But in the middle part, they're touching each other, and as you go around the ring, it's sort of more or less totally symmetrical. It's the same residues making interactions all around the ring. Now, what we think happens is that when the rotation is transmitted down this helix, or it tends to destabilize these weak hydrophobic interactions between the helices and therefore break this hydrophobic girdle that's forming the gate. Now, so what we're saying is these helices have to move in response to that twisting action. And for them to move, there has to be space, this move relative to the other outer parts that we observed didn't move. There has to be space at the back of them there. And also these loops connecting these helices to the other ones have to be flexible. Well, there are two things that seem to suggest that that's right, because these loops have glycine residues on either side of the membrane, and these glycines are sort of highly conserved as you go around the ring. It's the same in all the M2 helices as you go around the ring. And glycines allow rotational freedom around the peptide bond, so would allow such flexibility. And if you look at a section where the gate is, you can see there is quite a bit of space between these M2 helices and the wall of helices on the outside of them that are facing the lipids. And so what we think happens is that when the twist is transmitted down these helices, it breaks these bonds here, and this helix is sort of able to rotate back by 15 degrees along with the rest of the subunit. And because these interactions are the same as you go around the ring, probably the breaking of the bonds in this part and this part and this part and this part completely collapses the whole structure there. So it's a sort of cooperative change in the membrane, and the helices therefore just sort of drop back like that. They all probably move together. And indeed, they sort of have to do that to account for the changes that we saw when we compared the open channel and the closed channel in the membrane. What we observed, there was quite a big change in the middle of the membrane, the order of 3 or 4 angstroms amount of opening. And if you apply those rotations and you look at a space-filling model, it actually fits in perfectly with what we observed. So this is looking in the middle of the membrane with a space-filling representation of the atoms. it has a valine residue forming an, this hydrophobic ring, which is about 6 angstroms across and too small for hydrated iron to go through. And after we apply 15 degrees rotations, they just rotate into those holes at the back there. And the hole then becomes about 9 angstroms across. It probably becomes more polar because as the helix rotates around it, the hydrophobic side chains go more to the side. So both the increase in size and probably increase in polarity makes all the difference between that structure and this, those two structures, and it's probably big enough to let the ions go through. So let me summarize the way we think the channel works. So that's the complete structure, ligand binding domain and the membrane spanning pore, and these residues forming a blockage or an energy barrier in the middle of the membrane there. And when acetylcholine binds, it has to bind to both alpha subunits to open the channel, goes into the binding sites there, about midway along the ligand binding domain, and that causes this conformational change where they rotate by 15 degrees, the inner sheets rotate by 15 degrees, so it goes like that. And then these rotations are transmitted into this membrane spanning part, and you see it goes like that. It looks like it's just going sideways, but it's actually rotating at the same time. And the gate disappears because it gets bigger and probably more polar. And if you look at it down, it's sort of going like that. So let me just summarize that. In the ligand binding domain, it's an asymmetric movement involving mainly the alpha subunits. And probably this is because it's better, the acetylcholine receptor has to work very quickly, and it's better for it to just bind to two of the subunits rather than all five to open the channel. And also it's more efficient on the use of acetylcholine. If you only need two rather than five to open the channel, you're sort of saving on acetylcholine molecules. And this is enough to disturb the weak interactions which hold that hydrophobic girdle together. So it breaks open cooperatively and sort of collapses against the outer protein wall. And these movements are all quite small, and actually you couldn't even tell that the channel's opening and closing if you look from the side, say from the bottom there. And it seems to me that they're sort of energetically favorable. They're all sort of parallel to the plane of the membrane. And so all makes sense. And the final thing is to show the two people I work with on this. This is Atso. He looks quite a lot older than that in that first picture, and Tara. And this is Yoshi, who still seems to be the same as ever. But if you compare this picture with the previous one, his beard's actually gone grey. It was black before. Thank you. Not that good, actually. It hasn't been refined. It's just a rough fit. About 1,000. No, it's only about 1 in 100 that does a good prep of tubes, actually, and we've got no way of controlling that. So,
so you talked about charges. But have you done any electrostatic calculations, like a plus on both kind of thing, to see if there's any sort of electrostatic tuning here?
No. There's very many mutation experiments have been done to show that those charges do affect the conductance of the channel. Actually, everything that we see, it is actually marvelous. You know, those residues you know, they've mutated the residues, but there's some pointing inwards. There's a threonine at the bottom there. And it's obviously in a narrow part of the channel. You'd expect if you mutated it to a slightly bigger residue, it would lower the conductance, and indeed it does. So everything fits very well. We haven't actually done it, and we just concentrate on the EM. Yes, David. Oh, sorry. I don't mind.
What is the nature of the refractive state goes into
when it goes into the, no, we Michael Stowell in the lab has done a map of, it, of that structure at about 9 angstroms resolution, and what we see is in the ligand binding domain, it changes rather like it looks like the inner sheets rotate back like they do in the open channel structure, which you might expect. The acetylcholine is bound there in the binding site. And the part in the membrane actually looks like the closed channel. So it almost looks like, you know, it's sort of opened, and then there's some cumulative strain or something, and so the part in the membrane becomes decoupled and closes again. Maybe that valine residue that's in the top of that helix, it seems rather a weak sort of contact, and then maybe after a while the valine sort of moves out, and then it just sort of switches back to the original closed state. That sounds good, but the trouble is, again, people have done lots of mutation experiments of what happens in the desensitized state, and they say that in the membrane part, the structure is different in the desensitized state than it is in the closed state. What we seem to see is that it just uncouples and it's more or less the same. So we haven't tried to write the paper up yet because we can't quite understand it. I mean the whole idea is that when the channel's closed, there's a hole there that's 6 angstroms across, so the ion can't go through. But when it opens, it's 9 angstroms across, and that's actually a bigger diameter than a hydrated ion, at least if you take the first shell of hydration. So, of course, the ion it depends how many hydration shells you consider an ion to have, but it's dehydrated to some extent, probably going through, but it can go through retaining that first hydration shell. If everything we say about the structure is correct. We can resolve, yes. At the 4.6 angstrom map, we could see the individual they're not very clearly resolved. At 4 angstroms, they're slightly better, but it's not say as good as the tubulins structure with Eva and Ken and I think the whole structure has about 4 angstrom resolution. What are you trying to say? It's yeah. Yeah, I wouldn't say. Some of them are well resolved, but they're not all well resolved. Yeah, no, well, it doesn't distinguish between sodium and potassium. Sorry, does it what? Sorry,
both, yeah.
Yeah, it's a cation selective channel. It only worries about cations. Calcium will go through as well. So it's having strategically located negatively charged residues that tend to repel the anions and concentrate the cations there. The ones I described are right on either side of the pore, but there are also other ones as you go up that long tubular entrance. So I think it's a completely different sort of thing than the potassium. So you don't need dehydration, which you need in the case of the potassium channel to get this discrimination. And is there yes. Yes. Yeah, the other ones don't seem to be connected in the same way. They don't seem to have a direct connection. So it's only the two alphas that have this. They have a really strong density linking the top of the helix with the ligand binding domain. The other ones don't. But you know, in the residues, they're not valines. That they actually, I think that they're something like lysine there. So, you know, this resolution, you can't really say where the side chains are exactly, and that they could be touching, but it looks like if they are, they're rather flexible residues, so they might accommodate those movements up there. We haven't really got strong evidence that they're all moving in this cooperative way in the membrane, but it seems to make sense that when you have a symmetrical structure and you start pulling to pieces, it just sort of collapses. This happens with disassembly of a symmetrical virus. Intermediate states aren't very, very stable. And also we observe that there's a big change in that region when we compare the closed and the open channel. And if you just make the changes to the alpha subunit, it's not a big enough difference there to account for the overall change that we see. Yeah.
All right. One is, what can you read the rest? The second one, what does this experiment say? Not exactly the funnest program. The obvious funnest of the adult. Why are we not?
Yeah, well, I did say it was very rough. Yes. Well, how do you place the individual residues into the map? I think, you know, we can see, okay, you can tell that it's a helix. You know, you see a rod of density, and you see bumps coming out of it. And, there's some parts are fairly smooth and some parts have big bumps, you know, where there's, particularly where there are leucine side chains. The big side chains fit in the big bumps. And although you can't see, the other parts are smooth, you know it's a helix, so you know where the residues are. So when you've got a helix, I think, you know, you can do things fairly, fairly well. And yes, I think at 4 angstroms, I mean, you know, there's many examples of 4 angstroms maps where you've gone wrong by at least a turn in a helix. I don't think we have. We know from mutation experiments every residue, whether it's facing the pore or not. Actually, there's absolutely nothing controversial what we see, and nobody's complained about it. In this particular case, we did one. I mean, we could see all these details for 2 years before we sort of published anything, and we were very sure about this because, you know, we checked with all the available information. I mean, that's all one can say. Yeah, at this resolution, you can still make mistakes. We haven't really done we haven't done a proper refinement yet. Can I say a little bit more about what we're doing, if you like? So there's two things you can do. You can do these sort of X-ray crystallographic refinements where you can compare a model of your proposed atomic structure with the EM densities, and you can monitor progress in that sort of refinement. But you can also, the first thing to do before you do that is you want to improve the quality of the maps. And we're at that first stage at the moment. Actually, one thing that's quite interesting is that, actually, I don't know, there's a slide. What we can, at the moment, we know that we're very confident about the structure in the membrane. It's helical. The bends, you know, the bend residue is exactly where they agree very well with everybody's deduced positions. And actually the helix going down here, that's framing these windows. And that all makes sense. They actually have negatively charged residues that are framing the windows, and that's what probably makes it cation selective for the ions going, the potassium ions going through this way. And all this, you know, that's using the binding protein, and it's putting an ode, using real space refinement to a 4.6 angstrom density map, and now to a 4 angstrom map, and I think we can fit that very well. And what we've been able to do now is use these coordinates to calculate a model tube based on these coordinates, and then use this as a reference structure to compare all the images, all the 360 images. And our problem has always been that, you know, we take good images and we add them to build up this map. But we can never tell, we haven't been able to devise a method of telling how good an image is beyond a resolution of about 10 angstroms, because each image of a tube, there's not enough information there really to see clearly when you compare it with the normal reference. But if you use this structure from the coordinates as a reference, which sort of contains really good high resolution information, that's if you've got it right. It's a much better reference than the one that you're using when you're when you're deriving your structure. And some images agree nicely with this, but other ones don't agree so well. And what you can do is remove those ones that don't agree very well, calculate a new map, and you get a better map, and then that gives you a little bit more confidence in what you've got, and then you can actually extend this map a little bit. Then you can calculate a new model tube and then go back. And by going back and forth quite a bit, you can improve the map quite a lot. So and sort of extend into the loop regions. And so that's the process that we're doing at this moment. So we think that at the, you know, we haven't got, it's a very rough map, but we think, you know, with this sort of process and the refinement, it will be quite good. No, that's interesting. So you're saying, how do we know that it rotates at all in the membrane part? Well, when we looked at 9 angstrom resolution at the closed part in the membrane and the open part in the membrane, what we could observe was that, if a helix is rotating about its axis, you can't see it. Certainly at that resolution. But what we observe is the bottom part rotated in the same clockwise sense when you compared the open with the closed. So we know that there are indeed clockwise rotations of those helices occurring in the membrane. What we couldn't be sure because of the quality of the map was whether all of them rotated by the same amount, because we did a rotational average there. But we know there are clockwise rotations of the helices in the membrane, and we know there are clockwise rotations in the top part. And in the membrane, we know that these rotations just occur in that M2 helices, and the outer part doesn't change. So, I mean, that's what we see. And everything that we sort of model is consistent with what we've seen. And, you know, I feel that's quite a good point. You know, there's been lots of models of channels opening and closing and that, but they've just been models without the data there to support it. This does actually fit in with the data, although the data is with more resolution. So, I think in the membrane, it's quite delicately poised between the closed and the open state. You know, the helices, what you're doing with the ligand binding domain, it's just a sort of trigger part, and it's just pushing it towards stabilizing one state over the other state. So it's just a matter of altering the stability slightly. So maybe, you know, because it's only just favored, it tends to go back and forth all the time. It's not very stable in either of the two states. There might be something to do with that connection with the valine residue. It looks like a rather weak connection. Maybe it's a sort of connects and disconnects somehow. I don't know.